Hello everyone, this is Beverly Tomasian. Welcome to our seventh webcast for the boot camp. And today we have the exciting opportunity to do some practice test questions. So I've compiled 48 test questions. These are probably most of them new questions you haven't seen yet. And what I'm going to do is quickly go over them and launch some polls. I have the capacity to ask you 20 poll questions, so the first 20 will be a poll question, and the rest of them will just be we'll work through them together. So thanks for joining us. Let's get started because we have a lot to cover in an hour. You're almost to the finish line, and you've come so far. I mean, you've been coming to these boot camps, you've been reading, you've been doing your review guide, you've been reading your standards of care. You've been reading the ACE guidelines. I mean, you have just been fully focused on preparing for this exam, and I really want to commend you. I know what it takes to pass this exam. It's a lot, and there's been a lot of sacrifice on your end, and probably your loved ones and support people haven't seen you as much as they are used to seeing you. But after this exam, they're going to see you a lot more, and you're going to be a really happy person. So just to remind you of a few key things, I want you to listen to the Preparing for CDE free webcast. It's on my website, and it says right here, listen to recorded webinar. You can just click on that and listen immediately. And that you can even scroll halfway through, and halfway through, I talk about test taking tips and getting ready for the exam. And I think it's some really helpful information. We're going to talk about today special populations, programs, inpatient information, and if you feel that you want more information on these topics, our Level 2 online course bundle is designed for you. In that Level 2 online course, we kind of take it beyond Level 1 and we really delve down into special populations, programs, and so forth. It's not the meat and potatoes of this course because there's less questions on it, and many of you work mostly with adults. So I have to prioritize, and I spent most of my time talking about the majority of the population while recognizing how important it is to be knowledgeable about these other groups and about setting up programs. Wednesday, we are going to have our last webcast on behavior change, so we still have that to go. So we still have plenty of excitement to talk about. But let's get started on our first question. So I'll read it and I'll launch the poll, and then you just make your, you know, you choose the right answer. AT is a 43-year-old, newly started on insulin. Circle the survival topic that is essential to know before discharge. A, managing insulin doses when traveling across time zones. B, how to adjust insulin dose before exercise. C, signs of hypoglycemia, or D, how to adjust insulin dose based on carbohydrates consumed. Circle the essential survival topic that this patient needs to know before discharge. All right, I guess I have to launch it for you all to see it. Thanks for voting, everyone. We're expecting 90 degrees today in Chico, California. Getting hot. Okay, I'm going to close this and then share with you. So 93% of you chose the right answer. 7% of you said how to adjust insulin dose based on carbohydrate consumed. Let me just go back to the slide. So we have to really constantly prioritize with patients what is the most important thing they have to know before discharge, what's going to keep them safe. And you're going to get questions like this on the exam. The thing is, what is going to help this patient stay safe is ability to know signs of low and to treat it. How to adjust insulin dose based on carbohydrate is more of a critical thinking an advanced level skill. So C is the right answer. Good job. Good job, team. And if you didn't get it right, like I always say, it's okay. It's just information feedback for you. Number two, which of the following are characteristics of peripheral arterial disease? Is it A, ingrown toenails? B, pulses difficult to palpate due to edema? C, callus formation on the ball of the foot? Or D, intermittent claudication? Go ahead and launch that and see what you all come up with. Thanks for voting. Okay, I'm going to close a poll. Thank you. I'm going to share your results. So nobody chose A, ingrown toenails. That doesn't even make sense. B, pulses difficult to palpate due to edema. So 13% of you chose that. So that would characterize venous disease. Venous disease means the blood can get to the foot, but it just pools there, and there's a lot of edema. So you just want to make sure you know the difference between peripheral disease and venous disease. I'm sorry, I should say this different. Arterial disease versus venous disease. Venous disease is the blood can get there, but it pools. Arterial disease means there's such bad vessel disease, the blood has a hard time getting to the foot. And one of the signs of that is intermittent claudication. So intermittent claudication means when you walk, you get cramps in the back of your legs. It's because of poor arterial perfusion. And so intermittent claudication is a classic sign of peripheral arterial disease. So 87% of you got that right. Good job. Let's go to the next one. In the process of providing medical nutrition therapy for a person with diabetes, the goal is to improve overall diabetes control by A, providing a written meal plan, B, emphasizing portion control, C, assisting the person to make self-directed behavior changes, or D, using carbohydrate counting. Let me launch this. Good job, everybody. Okay. I feel that you all got the message that this test is about, well, I'll say it after I close the poll. Okay, I'm going to close the poll. Thank you. Most of you have voted and share the results. But 93% of you got the right answer. And I think the underlying theme of this exam is helping people make self-directed behavior changes. That, if I could say one thing, empowerment, we're coaching people to make changes themselves. We can't change anyone. And so I did put D in as a juicy answer using carbohydrate counting, but that is a strategy. We do teach carbohydrate counting, especially for somebody with type 1. We're going to do that, but the question doesn't ask if do they have. It doesn't say, oh, they've got type 1. What strategy should we use? It talks about overall diabetes control. So C is the best answer. I hope that helps. So always looking for the best answer based on the stem of the question. For a person with type 1 diabetes, this is question 4, who is using intensive diabetes therapy, meals and snacks should be scheduled, or can be scheduled according to A, usual eating habits, B, insulin action times, C, the calorie content, or D, meal spacing. I'm going to go ahead and launch that. Good job, everyone. Thank you for voting. Okay, one more second. I want to close this. There's 200 questions on the exam. You have 4 hours. So you want to make sure you pace yourself. So you just want to read the question really carefully and choose the best answer. Okay, I'm going to close this and share with you all. So 94% of you chose the correct answer. With people with diabetes, we say, tell us your usual eating habits. We're going to work the therapy around you. So B looks not is not looking at the person, it's looking at the pathology or the pathophysiology or the pharmacokinetics of insulin. But we know with intensive diabetes therapy, we have to base the therapy on the person's usual habits. So that kind of gets back again to our self-directed and empowerment model, right? So if you didn't get that right, that's okay. Just want to keep that other thing in mind. Oh my goodness, check this out. So a lot of your questions are going to look like this. Really long vignettes with a ton of information. So get ready for these, okay? Just psychologically prepare yourself. And what you're going to say is, I'm just going to find the main question that they're asking and root out all the other stuff. JJ is 45 years old and has had type 2 diabetes for 5 years. He would like to begin an exercise program, which includes jogging 3 times a week with a friend for 2 miles. It takes about 30 minutes. He takes a sulfonylurea to control his diabetes. If his blood glucose is 80 before exercise, how much carbohydrate will he need to consume to prevent hypoglycemia? A. None. B. 15 grams of carb. C. 30 grams. Or D. 45 grams of carbohydrate. Now, on my question I'm going to launch for you right now, I had to abbreviate the vignette because I only have a certain amount of words I can use. So it's not going to exactly match, but you just want to use the question. I carried forth the key intent of the question. So would they ask this on the exam? Oh yeah, this is a very typical question. A person's going to exercise for this long, how much carb do they need to replace it? That's the essential question that they're asking. And you also need to know, what's the sulfonylurea? That's an important key to this question. Okay, most of you have voted. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share with you. So 6% of you said none. Okay, so let's go over this. He's on a sulfonylurea, and the sulfonylurea can cause hypoglycemia. Those are the medications that stimulate your pancreas to make more insulin. So anyone on a sulfonylurea or insulin, if their blood sugar, so the other piece of information that's really important is that his glucose, I'm going to actually hide the results so you can take a look at the slide. His glucose is less than 80 before he exercises. So those are two key things. He's going to exercise, well, he's on a sulfonylurea, his blood sugar is 80, and the other key thing is because he's going to exercise for 30 minutes. So you need to know sulfonylureas lower blood sugar. So if I'm below 100 and I'm on a sulfonylurea, I need carbohydrates to make sure I don't go too low. Based on 30 minutes of exercise, the right answer, which 82% of you chose, is B, 15 grams. So you may say to me, well, how do I know that? Well, in the last class on exercise and nutrition, I put a little chart in your handout that says, based on this amount of exercise, you're going to need this much carbohydrate. But pretty standard is 15 grams for 30 minutes if you're on sulfonylureas or insulin and your blood sugar is less than 100. That's just pretty standard. Okay, great job, team. Poll question 6. MJ is 78 years old with type 2 diabetes, taking 2 daily insulin injections. Since MG lives alone, which of the following is most important to assess? A. Ability to check urine ketones. B. Level of activity. C. Level of social support. Or D. Ability to accurately withdraw and inject insulin. I'm going to go ahead and launch this. I actually put the word most in caps. They don't do that on the exam. So you want to be looking out for these words in the questions and in the answers. Most, always, none, usually. Those are real key words you want to be just looking for as you dissect questions and answers. You take one more second. Oh, Sally wants to know, what's the passing score on the exam? I want to say it's 70 scaled units. Yeah, 70. So you'll see when you get your results, they'll have your absolute number that you got right and the scaled number you got right. You see, each point on the exam has a different value. So easy questions might have a value of 1, and harder questions might value 2 or 3 points. So they're called scaled points or scaled units. So you have to get at least a passing score of 70. Okay, anyways, I'm going to share your results, and 94% of you got this right. So 6% of you chose C, level of social support. Now, that is a juicy answer because I'm always talking about social support, looking at the individual. But when a person lives alone and they're on insulin, the most important thing is can they accurately withdraw and inject it? That's going to trump social support in this situation. So just, kind of really think about what the question is asking and what would be the best answer. Okay, good job, you guys. Poll question number, oh, I think I skipped one, 7. What are symptoms of angina for people with diabetes and cardiac autonomic neuropathy? Is it A, fatigue, dyspnea, and diaphoresis? Is it B, crushing chest pain? Is it C, pain radiating to the jaw? Or is it D, burning pain in the legs? And so if you want more information on the test and the setup of the test, that free webinar on preparing for the CDE exam goes over that in a lot of detail. So that would be a good resource for you. I talk a lot about the setup, objectives, content, test taking skills, on and on. Yes. And of course, I'm always cheering for all of you. So you've got a whole cheerleading section rooting for you when you sit down at that exam, and we're actually even cheering for you when you're studying. So that's good to know. Oh, geez. I'm sorry, you guys. On this, on your, on the poll question right now, I can see I was cutting and pasting. That B is kind of a funky answer because it says fatigue, dyspnea, diaphoresis, maybe, and crushing chest pain. So, anyways, I'm going to go ahead and close a poll and I'll talk about the right answer. So I just want to say, share with you that A is the best answer. And I'll tell you why. When you have diabetes, autonomic neuropathy, and anyway, 71% of you got that right, so great job. But when you have diabetes and cardiac autonomic neuropathy, what does that mean? So neuropathy is nerve damage. Autonomic are those systems that function behind the scenes. And a person with diabetes who has cardiac autonomic neuropathy will not be able to feel the normal signs of a heart attack. This is really, really important to know. And this is important to know for the exam, but also for real life. Because what happens is their nerves to their heart are not working correctly. There's been nerve damage. So B is the wrong answer. They will not feel crushing chest pain. They will not feel that. I would, or if they have this degree of neuropathy, how would you know somebody has cardiac autonomic neuropathy? Well, they have signs like resting tachycardia, so their pulse rate is higher than 100 when they're sitting, or when they exercise, their heart rate doesn't go up above 100. It's called exercise intolerance. But if people have other types of neuropathy, I often assume they have cardiac autonomic neuropathy. So I'm cautious with them. And I tell them that you're not going to feel normally pain radiating to the jaw or crushing chest pain. The signs they might get of a heart attack are fatigue, dyspnea, and diaphoresis, and a sense that something isn't right. So A is the right answer, and that's important to know. And I talk about this in the complications section of my online courses, but this is so important to know. I had a patient, she was volunteering for me, and I was just having some back pain and like in her lower in her upper back between her ribs. We sent her to the emergency room, and she was having angina, so she didn't feel it in a normal presentation because of her diabetes. So A was the right answer on that. Okay, poll question 8. Hyperglycemia during hospitalization is associated with poor outcomes due to A. Decreased insulin resistance, increased insulin secretion, and increased counterregulatory hormones. B. Increased free fatty acids, ketones, lactate, inflammatory cytokines. C. Increased nitric oxide levels. Or D. Risk of alkalosis. So what is the right answer for that one? And again, I had to abbreviate the answers because there's not enough room in the poll question function. So you just want to maybe reference your handouts for the complete answer choices. Okay, good job, everyone. Are they going to be asking questions about hospitalization? Yeah. Are they going to be asking about inpatient targets? Probably. Depends on your exam. Okay, I'm going to close this. So you guys are on fire. I had a juicy answer I was trying to lure you in with, and nobody chose it. But you all chose the right answer, which is B, increase free fatty acids, ketones, lactate, inflammatory cytokines. Let me just talk about this for a minute. Nobody got lured in, but a lot of times in the exam they're going to use these long-winded, big words, you know, with a lot of, I don't know, like you've heard them before, so you feel like, oh my gosh, is this the right answer? Don't be lured in by them. Like you guys weren't, so you did a great job, but you're going to see this in other ways on the exam. Just break the words down to what they mean. For example, when you're sick and you're hyperglycemic, you don't have decreased insulin resistance, you have increased. You don't have increased insulin secretion, you have decreased. So they'll do this a lot. They'll change the decrease, increase associated with a phenomena. They'll flip it around. And so just make sure you read all the words carefully, just like you did right now, and figure out what is the right answer. So 100% of you chose the right answer that when you're in a stress state, there's more free fatty acids, ketones, lactate, and more inflammation. So inflammation and hyperglycemia go hand in hand. Number 9. Which of the following statement best reflects the goal of glucose management in the hospital setting? Is it A, better to let sugars run too high rather than too low? B, oral medications are the therapy of choice for inpatient? C, all patients admitted with a blood glucose greater of 126 should be started on an insulin drip? Or D, insulin therapy is a treatment of choice to manage inpatient hyperglycemia? Let me launch this. Okay. So if you don't work in a hospital, you're not familiar with the inpatient targets and goals, there's a section in the standards of care that covers that. And also, I do have a webcast on hospital care that you can take a listen to in our level two. But right now, you guys are just totally nailing the right answer. So I'm going to close this and share with you. 100% of you got the answer right. Insulin therapy is a treatment of choice to manage inpatient hyperglycemia. Oral medications, those are generally resumed when the patient's getting ready for discharge. So we'll take them off orals, put them on insulin. And if the blood sugar is 126 on admission, that means maybe they have undetected diabetes, but it doesn't mean they should be started on an insulin drip. So good job, you guys. Okay, I'm going to hide the results and go on to question 10. Under Medicare guidelines, which of the following statements is most accurate? Patients with type 2 diabetes are covered for 100 strips every 3 months. Patients with diabetes can retake the group classes every calendar year with approval from their referring MD. Or C, Medicare A will cover the cost of diabetes self-management program, Part A. Or D, under Medicare, only group classes are reimbursed. So let me launch this. So do you need to be familiar with Medicare billing, what they cover, Medicare A and B for the exam? Yeah, you do. So where would you get that information? Well, if you work in a program that does billing for diabetes education, you would get that information. Otherwise, I have a webinar on setting up a successful diabetes program and Medicare billing. It's called Setting Up a Successful Program in Level 2, or in the Art and Science book, they should have information on that. I'll double check. Okay. So, since education programs do bill Medicare, the test writers and the people who develop this exam think we should be familiar with that, which I think is pretty reasonable. And it's not real in-depth information. It's kind of questions like this that they'll show up. So get familiar with those Medicare guidelines. Okay, I'm going to close this, and maybe I'll see if I can get some more resources for you. So let me just share the results. And A is the right answer of all of these answers. So let me go over these with you all. So patients with type 2 diabetes, if they're not on insulin, get 100 strips for 3 months. That means a strip a day. So that is the right answer. Now, I had this B, which was kind of a juicy answer. Patients with diabetes can retake the group class every year. That's not true. Medicare says you can come to group classes once in your lifetime. Once they've come, they cannot come to the group classes again, but they can come to individual appointments with a dietitian or diabetes educator. So that would be okay. C, Medicare Part A covers the cost of diabetes self-management program. Actually, no, it's Medicare Part B. So you need to know that B is what covers diabetes education. So that, I'm glad we went over that. That was really good information sharing for Medicare. So good. I'm glad we did that poll question. Let's go on to number 11. Looking at a diabetes recognized program, what professional instructional staff are required to establish a recognized program? A, at least one healthcare professional with a CDE. B, an RN and an RD, one of which has a CDE. C, either an RN, RD, or PharmD with recent education in diabetes. Or D, a healthcare professional with chronic disease management experience. Let me launch that. So again, we're looking at the program guidelines. And this is either the American Diabetes Association or the American Association of Diabetes Educators. They both approve or recognize diabetes education programs. So I have a really good article I'm going to put on your resource page. It's the ADA ADA consensus statement on setting up a diabetes program, what has to be included. I'm going to add that to your resource page based on your answers right now. Okay, I'm going to close this poll. Okay. So let me share this with you, because this we had a lot of what's the word? It was inconsistent. Like normally there's one answer that really pulls out, but here we had one stronger answer, but let's spend some time on this. So at least one healthcare professional with a CDE, that's A. 35% of you chose that. That's the wrong answer. That used to be the answer, but they've changed that. They realized that there's a lot of education happening in rural places. So an RN or an RD or a pharmacist who has education, recent education in diabetes can be the instructional staff member. So this is not the program manager, it's the instructional staff. So a C is the right answer. Let's see, B, a RN and RD, one of which has a CDE. No, they don't require both disciplines. It can be either a nurse, a dietitian, or a pharmacist, none of which has to have a CDE as the instructional staff. And D is the wrong answer. It has to be at least RN, RD, or PharmD. So the right answer was C, and 40% of you got the right answer. The rest of you, I'm going to post that article that I would take a look at before the exam, because there's going to be questions. This is called program management on the exam regarding this. Medicare reimbursement program management. And also, as I mentioned, I have a whole web course and level two on that. Okay, number 12. A patient arrives at the educator's office for his individual assessment and states that he only wants to learn how to use his new glucose meter. What is the best approach in this situation? A. The educator should gently inform the patient that they are required to cover seven different content areas. B. Focus on areas where educator has the most knowledge and skills to impart. C. Acknowledge a patient's request and frame the response based on the educator's desired program outcomes. Or D. Base the education on the needs of the individual patient. What are we going to do? All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. This is fun. Monday morning, we get to do a test. Well, it might be Monday afternoon for some of you out on the East Coast. Well, it's really lunchtime. All right. I'm going to close this poll. So again, 94% of you totally rocked this. Great job, you guys. Now, 6% of you chose C. Now, I just want to talk about C a little bit. I'm going to hide the results because sometimes they will do this in a question. They'll start the answer off with a really nice answer, like acknowledge the patient's request. Oh, that sounds really nice. I should do that. Yeah, so the first half of the question is right, but the second half is wrong. So look out for those because they will often do that. Start it off really nice, and then your brain kind of fills in the blanks on the tail end. Don't let your brain fill in the blanks. Read the entire question. I'm sorry. Well, read the entire question and the entire answer. So it says here, frame the response based on the educator's desired program outcome. No, we do it based on the patient's desired, outcomes and goals. Oh, Sally wants to know, based on last question, what kind of diabetes education? Oh, it's to establish a recognized diabetes education program. So we'll talk about that afterward. Okay. Poll question 13. Which of the following statements is true regarding preconception care for women with existing diabetes? A. Spontaneous abortion rates have been found to correlate with A1C values during the first trimester. B. Preconception glucose control can eliminate the risk of congenital anomalies and spontaneous abortion. C. Most women in the U.S. with type 1 and 2 achieve optimal glucose control prior to pregnancy. Or D. Major malformations occur after 8 weeks gestation. So again, the answers were kind of wordy, so I couldn't fit the complete answer in the poll question. So you might have to refer to your handouts during this. So this is choosing the best answer. Now, if you don't work much with diabetes and pregnancy, this is definitely an area you want to spend some time studying. There are going to be questions about women who have pre-existing diabetes or women who get diabetes during pregnancy, also termed gestational diabetes. So, if you, like for example, in my clinic, I mostly work with 70 to 100-year-old patients. I don't see much pregnancy, but I read a lot about it so I can be knowledgeable about it. And I've worked with pregnancy, with women who are pregnant in the past, so I have that knowledge to draw on too. Okay, I'm going to close this and share your results. So there was two competing questions. A, spontaneous abortion rates have been found to correlate with A1C values in the first trimester. And then there's B, preconception glucose can eliminate the risk of congenital anomalies. So let me just talk about this for a little while. So A is the right answer. A is the right answer. And that is what it's saying is that the higher the level of A1C during the first trimester of pregnancy, the higher the rate of the fetus aborting and the pregnancy aborting, because high glucose levels during pregnancy increase congenital problems, especially in the first trimester. So A is the right answer. Now this B is a juicy answer. You want to choose it, but it's not right because it says preconception glucose control can eliminate the risk of congenital anomalies. And the word here, eliminate, is the real critical word, because this means before the person gets pregnant, they have excellent blood sugar control, but what about the first 3 months? It doesn't talk about, you know, what happens during those first few months of pregnancy, and that's when actually the problems happen if their blood sugars are high during the first 3 months. But we can never say it's going to eliminate the risk. The risk is always there. I mean, even if a woman doesn't have diabetes and they get pregnant, there's always a risk of congenital anomalies and spontaneous abortion. So B is the wrong answer. Look out for statements like this. Never eliminate that. Don't give any room for other possibilities. So A is the right answer. Okay, let's go on to the next one. 14. Which of the following medications are approved for use in pregnancy? Is it A, statins, B, ACE inhibitors, C, human insulin, or D, thiazolidine diones? Which of the following medications are approved for use during pregnancy? And when I say approved for use, I'm talking about FDA approval. Do we need to know this? Yeah, it's really important, because any woman, if she's of childbearing age and she has diabetes and she's on medications, we need to make sure she's on safe medications before conception. Okay, I'm going to close this and share the results on fire. 100% of you got the right answer, human insulin. Yes. All of these other ones, well, these first two are teratogenic and are not safe for pregnancy, and thiazolidine diones are not FDA approved during pregnancy. The only one that is C. So what I was saying is, if you're working with a type 2, and there are many times our type 2 women who are, you know, looking toward getting pregnant or maybe not using birth control, if they're on a statin or ACE inhibitor, that can be very dangerous for the developing fetus. We need to make sure they know that in preparation for pregnancy. Okay, let's take a look at another one. Mrs. S is 25 pounds overweight, has type 2 diabetes and normal A1C. She takes canagliflozin, which is Invokana, and that's how you'll usually see the drugs listed in the exam, generic plus the trade, and follows her meal plan. In discussing preconception care, the educator will suggest which of the following: A, delay conception until she achieves a 25-pound weight loss; D, discontinue Invokana and start patient on insulin; C, start patient on prenatal vitamins; or D, discontinue metformin and start glyburide. Well, I'm sorry, I changed this. It used to be metformin. Discontinue Invokana is what it should say, and start glyburide. Which of these are the right, which of this is the right answer? Which should the educator suggest? All right, I see a lot of shifting here, so you guys are thinking hard about the right answer. Okay, I'm going to close this. One more vote. Okay, and share the results. So, 17% of you said delay conception until she achieves a 25-pound weight loss. Well, That's probably not going to be re a realistic goal for this patient. So, could it be a right answer? Yeah, but it's not the best answer. It's not the safest answer. And there's better answers within the context of these choices. And so this A is not the right answer because it's not realistic. And what if she does get pregnant? And so she's thinking about getting pregnant. We have to set her up for safety and success. And Invokana has not been, used I mean, it's not approved for FDA approved during pregnancy. And so if we say, well, don't get pregnant till you lose 25 pounds, keep on your Invokana, but what if she does get pregnant? Now she's on a medication that's not approved during pregnancy, and we don't know the consequence of that. So B is the best answer. Discontinue Invokana and start patient on insulin. Insulin is FDA approved during pregnancy. And then some of you chose D, 11%, so which would should say discontinue Invokana and start glyburide. Now, glyburide is used during pregnancy, but for the purpose of this exam, I would really say focus on starting insulin because insulin is the only FDA-approved medication during pregnancy. I know in a lot of our clinics will use it, and even this year, the ADA recognized that some women during pregnancy do take glyburide, but it's not FDA-approved. So I would be conservative and say start them on insulin. So B is the right answer, and 72% of you got that right. Good job, you guys. So you can see during the exam, there's shades of gray. And so you always want to say, what's the best answer? That's our target here. Okay, poll question 16. Which of the following is a correct retinopathy screening guideline according to the American Diabetes Association? A. For both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, a dilated eye exam should be done upon diagnosis. B. Eye exams must be provided in person by an experienced ophthalmologist or optometrist. D. Laser photocoagulation should be provided to patients with non-proliferative retinopathy. Or D. Patients with new onset type 2 require a dilated eye exam upon diagnosis. Let me launch that. Okay. Good job, everyone. We'll take one more second. Okay, I'm going to close the poll. Thanks for voting. Okay, so let me share the results. 26% of you chose A. Type 1 and type 2 diabetes, an eye exam should be done upon diagnosis. Okay, that's the wrong answer. Now, how would you know this? You have to look at the standards of care. The thing with type 1 diabetes, since they probably haven't had their diabetes very long, type 1s usually get diagnosed within a few months of having the condition. They don't have a chance yet to get eye or kidney or nerve disease. So you'll see when you look at the standards, type 1 compared to type 2, type 1s usually need to get it done within 5 years, the screening activities. But type 2, since on average it can take 6 years to 6 years to diagnose somebody with type 2, we need to do it upon diagnosis. So type 2, we do the screenings on diagnosis immediately. Type 1s, usually within a 5-year window, and that's different for the different screenings. But take a look at that. It's in the standards of care, and I also cover it in my complications webinar. So A is the wrong answer. And then 5% of you chose B. Eye examinations must be provided in person by an experienced ophthalmologist or optometrist. Well, now we can do eye examinations through distance evaluations. So the initial screen must be done by an ophthalmologist or optometrist in person, but the follow-up, the annual checkups can be done off-site. If you take the picture with a retinal camera and you send it off to the ophthalmologist or optometrist, they can interpret it. So B is the wrong answer. But C was the, I'm sorry, C is nobody chose that. Great job. D is the right answer. Patients with new onset type 2 require a dilated eye exam upon diagnosis. And I want to clarify, it can be done by an ophthalmologist or an optometrist. So either specialist is qualified to do the eye exam. Oh my goodness, look at this one. So I didn't do a poll question for this. We're just going to work through this together. Mr. J is an 89-year-old who lives alone and has mild retinopathy. His A1C is 9.7, and the MD has written a prescription to start him on intensive insulin therapy. The prescription reads 3 units of Humalog before each meal and 10 units of Lantus at bedtime. Patient to add 1 unit of Humalog to mealtime dose for every 50 points above 150. What would be the best first response to this situation? A. Contact the prescribing doctor and ask to change the patient's regimen to 10 units of 70/30 twice a day. B. Start by instructing the patient on how to safely withdraw and inject insulin. C. Assess the patient's ability to inject 4 times a day and calculate insulin dose based on blood glucose levels. And D. Assess the patient's knowledge of hypoglycemia identification and treatment. So I'm going to get my pen. So this first one, contact the prescribing doctor and ask to change a patient's regimen to 10 units 70/30 BID. That is a juicy answer, but it's not the right answer because we haven't really assessed what's happening yet. So I do want to say also in the exam, before we take action, we want to assess. So this is not the right answer, although it is kind of tempting. I want to choose it. We haven't done any assessment yet. Let's keep going. Start by instructing the patient on how to safely withdraw and inject insulin. Okay, well, that's really not the best answer. Yeah, we want to make sure they can safely withdraw and inject, but I'm gonna just really don't think that's right. Let me keep going. Assess the patient's ability to inject 4 times a day and calculate insulin dose on blood glucose. Okay, this answer seems right to me because they're asking an 89-year-old to, inject 3 times a day bolus and then add on the sliding scale if he's elevated and then give Lantus at night. So maybe this guy can really do that. Maybe he's real, assertive and involved, has great cognition. He's 89, but he's really independent and he can do it. And I've met patients like that. But maybe he can't do that. But how do we know unless we assess? So this looks like a really good answer to me. Let's go look at D. Assess the patient's knowledge of hypoglycemia and treatment. Well, that's just a little piece of the puzzle. We really want to look at what's the best answer, and I hope you all agree that C is the best answer given the situation. So let me go on to the next one. Oh. I've got to erase this. Let's see. Erase all drawings. Okay. Did we skip 17? I did skip 17. Thank you for asking. When I was looking at 17 today, I thought it was not a well-written question, so I want to skip it and rewrite it for you all because it was kind of ambiguous, the answers. So sometimes when you write questions, you don't catch the nuances, so I want to fix that and get it back to you all. Thanks for checking. Okay, 19. Mrs. S is having trouble sleeping and complains of waking up with frequent nightmares. Her insulin dose includes 5 to 8 units of Novolog at breakfast and dinner, 12 units. Oh, so Novolog at breakfast and dinner, and 12 units of MPH at bedtime. You may be asking me, is there MPH on the exam? Oh, yes, there is. They still talk about MPH, so get ready. She complains that her before-bed blood sugar is often greater than 300, so she takes extra insulin before going to bed to bring it down. What is your best response? So what's the key intent of this question? She complains that her blood sugar is often more than 300 before bed. A. Instruct patient to decrease MPH insulin by 2 units to prevent nocturnal hypoglycemia. B. Contact provider and request to discontinue MPH and start Lantus instead. That's funny. See, it says if the patient is having a snack before checking her bedtime glucose levels, or D, encourage patient to adjust her dinner time Novolog to prevent hyperglycemia at bedtime. What did you all think the right answer was? Well, let's go over this together. Let me get my highlighter again. So we're not going to instruct her to decrease the MPH by 2 units to prevent nocturnal. That's not her problem. She's taking extra bolus insulin. We don't know what kind. She could be taking MPH or bolus before she goes to bed to bring it down. So whatever she's doing, it doesn't making sense. It's not working for her. But A is the right is not the right answer. We're not going to instruct her to decrease her MPH. That doesn't even make sense. Okay. Contact provider to request discontinue MPH and start Lantus instead. No, that's not going to help her situation. She's high at bedtime. How do we fix this high at bedtime? A, assess if the patient is having a snack before checking her bedtime blood glucose level. Okay, that I am going to consider as a possible right answer. It has the word assess in it. I'm not going to take action, yet, but let's look at D. Encourage patient to adjust her dinner time Novolog to prevent hyperglycemia at bedtime. Okay, I think this would be the best answer. C is close to a best answer, but even if she is having a snack, it shouldn't go to 300. You see, when she's going to bed and her checking her blood sugars and it's 300 before she goes to bed, it seems like she would have to eat a lot to get it there, and it's telling me that she's not taking enough insulin before her dinner time meal. So assess could be an answer, but I'm going to say no, and I'm going to choose as a best answer D. And you guys could argue with me on that, but I would say let's give you the Novolog before dinner to get your post-meal blood sugar down. So the bedtime blood sugar looks at post-dinner, and it should be less than 180. So I'm going to take a look at her dinner Novolog, because here's the worst thing, you guys, is that people take Novolog at bedtime to get their blood sugar down. It's so dangerous, and it's not going to help her to adjust her MPH. She needs to do something more at dinner time. She has postprandial hyperglycemia after dinner. Okay, so D is the best answer. So again, on the exam, you're going to have to choose sometimes between two really close answers. Okay, let's do another one. Mr. C is a 47-year-old firefighter who injects 15 units of Dedamir at night and 10 units of 70/30 in the morning. He also injects Byetta 10 micrograms BID. So they would have the generic and the trade name here. I just didn't have enough room. His A1C is 7.3, and his goal is to lower his A1C below 7. His blood glucose levels are in the low 100s in the morning, but frequently above 130 before lunch and 180 above dinner. What is the best action? Is it A, encourage him to eat an additional 15 grams of carbohydrate at breakfast? B, hold a 70/30 unit insulin for a few days to determine his baseline blood glucose during the day and recalibrate his AM insulin dose? Is it C, increase the AM 70/30 to 12 units? Or is it D, switch the 70/30 insulin to 50/50? Now, when we say increase and switch, of course, we're doing that in collaboration with the provider. Okay, so this is a very common type of question you might get. There's a lot of details here. You have to sort through the details. Let's just take a look at it one more time. What is Dedamir? 15 units of Dedamir at night. It's a basal insulin, so we need to know that. He gets 15 units of basal insulin at night and 10 units of 70/30. What is 70/30? 70/30 is 70% long-acting, 30% bolus. 70% basal, 30% bolus. So this 70/30 is going to work its hardest before, well, it works its hardest before lunch and before dinner. So dinner and lunch blood sugars are reflected in the 70/30. And then he also takes Byetta 10 micrograms twice a day. So that's also known as exenatide, and that's the max dose. His A1C is a little bit elevated. And let's just take a look at his blood sugars. His blood sugars are in the low 100s in the morning. So that what does that tell us? He's getting enough Dedamir at night Fasting blood sugar is a reflection of nighttime basal. He's fine. But frequently above 130 before lunch and above 180 before dinner, what is the best action? Okay, so we're not going to do this. We're not going to encourage him. So anyways, that's how I want you to break down these really long-winded questions. Really just think through it. Get a good picture of what's happening. We're not going to encourage him to eat more carbs at breakfast. Hold a 70-30 for a few days to recalibrate? No, that's the wrong answer. Now, I like this one. Increase the 70-30 in the morning to 12 units. That makes sense because his lunch and dinner are high, and I know that would help. So that is going to be, looks like the right answer. And switching the type of insulin, I don't think that's going to help. So C is the right answer, increasing morning 70-30. And I hope you all got the same results as what I did. But the main thing I want to say for this is just focusing on breaking down these complex questions. Okay, now we're back to poll questions because I needed to spend time on those and really I can't put them on a poll, but these I can't put on a poll. They're short. Which factor is often associated with insulin resistance? When you get to these questions, you'll be like, thank goodness, because there'll be a mix of long-winded questions and more brief questions like this. What factor is often associated with insulin resistance? A, hypergonadism. B, acanthosis nigricans. C, excessive hunger. Or D, waistline less than 35 inches. Let's launch this and see what you get. Okay, I'll take a few more minutes to vote. Okay, thank you everyone. I'm going to close it and share. So 6% of you chose hypergonadism. And so sometimes you're going to be given terms you're not familiar with and that you might just take your best guess. So try if you can to break down what these words mean. Like hyper means high, gonadism is a reproductive organs in a man. So that doesn't really go together with insulin resistance. Okay, so I'm trying to think if there's any links, but I don't think so. So acanthosis nigricans though, so if you don't know these words, it's how would you figure out the right answer? We'll try and get rid of wrong things. So like hypergonadism would have to do with sexuality or sexual function. So it has to do with reproduction more. But acanthosis nigricans, blackening of the skin, you may not know that, but you can know that the A is wrong. Excessive hunger, you know that's wrong with insulin resistance. It's not what they're talking about. And then waistline less than 35 inches. Nobody chose that. So sometimes if you're not sure, try and break it down, get rid of wrong answers, and then if you get rid of wrong answers, you have a 50% chance of choosing the right answers if only two are left. So I would just suggest that to you. I hope that was helpful. Sometimes you just are not going to know the answer. It's okay. Just keep going. You know what I'm saying? Don't worry about it. Just say, you know what? I'm not sure. I'm going to make my best choice, and I'm going to move on. And that's what you want. How you want to talk to yourself. Because if you get stressed out that, hey, I missed that, I don't know what it was, just let it go. And if you're really feeling like everything's tightening up and you're stressed, actually right now, everybody stand up. Stand up. Stretch. And then put your hands on your hips. Remember we talked about that? Or even when you're sitting at the polling station. I've been talking about polls in my dreams. Even when you're at the desk taking the test, raise your arms above the level of your head. It will help calm you down. Raising your arms above the level of your head for a minute or two lowers your adrenaline, increases your testosterone. So now I'm talking about sex hormones again. Increases your testosterone and it helps you focus. Do it. Move. You're not going to get in trouble for moving, standing, stretching, taking a deep breath, raising your arms. Just shake it up. Let it go. Keep going. Okay? I really hear my voice when you're taking that test, coaching you, supporting you, cheering you on. Okay, 22. According to the American Diabetes Association standards, who should be screened for type 1 diabetes? A. High-risk individuals based on family history of autoimmune disease. B. All teenagers at puberty. C. High-risk ethnic groups. Or D. All individuals starting at the age of 45. Let me launch this. Okay, good job, team. Okay, nobody went for any of my juicy answers. Okay, I'm going to close this because I can see you guys are just, you know, totally, oh yeah, we know this. So it is true that autoimmunity and family history are really the indicators of who should get screened for type 1 diabetes. And there are some that we know how to screen for type 1. We can look at autoantibodies, the GAD, ICA, and IAA. And that's what TrialNet is all about. I'm just going to give a plug for TrialNet because just the other day I was at my kid's school and then there's a new kid diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And I said, you've got to contact TrialNet. So trialnet.org, you can just Google that in. And I go, because they're doing trials to see if they can protect beta cells. This kid only had type 1 for 60 days. And there's intervention trials going on right now as we speak to see if they can't preserve whatever remaining beta cells. I was doing a program in Carmel the other day, and the AV guy said, oh, my kid's son just got type 1. Told him about TrialNet, and that kid actually got hooked up to a trial. So get the word out. Anybody with type 1 in their family, newly diagnosed or living with it for a while, TrialNet study is a free study run by the NIH trying to understand the natural progression of type 1 and also provide intervention. Oh, we need siblings. Oh, Melanie, you're loving me right now. I'm totally pushing TrialNet. So Melanie must be familiar with TrialNet. She goes, we need siblings. That's a really good point. They're looking at the natural history of type 1. So if one sibling gets type 1, does the other sibling get it? And what environmental factors increase or decrease the risk? Because we're trying to figure out the environmental influences too and seeing, you know, if they become immunocompromised and get type 1 diabetes. It's not really immunocompromised, but that if their immune system is attacked and they get the autoimmunity situation too. So anyways, thank you. We need siblings. Talk about TrialNet. Okay, keep going, Beverly. Question 23. Which of the following is the correct glucose goal for a 6 to 12-year-old child with type 1 diabetes? Is it A, pre-meal blood glucose is 70 to 130, B, post-meal blood glucose less than 200, C, A1C less than 7, or D, pre-meal glucose 90 to 130? What is the right answer? Oh. So Melanie says both of her sons are in it, one with type 1 diabetes and one and her sibling and the sibling of her child. So nice, Melanie. Sorry, I didn't launch my poll. Yeah, I've met a lot of families, you know, with somebody with type 1 in their family, and many of the siblings are enrolled, and it's so helpful. You get a lot of good information too from being a part of it. So are they going to ask about kids in this exam? Yeah, they're going to ask about glucose goals and targets for pediatrics. And so you want to be familiar with the 2015 targets. That's really important. And let me close this and share it with you. So 87% of you chose the right answer. It is a pre-meal blood glucose 90 to 130. And why would they let this run a little bit higher? For safety reasons. So we know with younger kids, we don't want to get their blood sugars down too low, the risk of hypoglycemia, because they may not be able to verbalize or recognize they're getting low, and it can be really dangerous. So the target is 90 to 130. And if you're not familiar with kids, I would definitely read the ADA standards. They have a whole section on goals for pediatrics. Well, speaking of goals, blood glucose goals, let's do one more. Choose the correct inpatient goal for non-critical patients. Inpatient glucose goal. So these are patients on the floor. Is it A, fasting blood glucose less than 126? B, post-meal blood glucose less than 200? C, premium blood glucose less than 110, or D, premium blood glucose less than 140. What is the right answer? Launch this poll. Okay, thanks for voting. Okay, take a few more seconds. Okay, I'm going to close it. Okay, so I'm just going to spend a few minutes on this because I did put some juicy answers in here. And the first juicy answer I put was a fasting blood sugar of 126. And they're going to do that on the exam. And the reason I chose this number is because I knew you would recognize it and go, oh, that looks good. But if fasting blood glucose less than 126 is a diagnostic criteria for diabetes. That's how we tell if you have diabetes, fasting blood sugar 126 or greater, usually repeat it times two. So that's why I put that there, but that is not the right answer because now we're looking for inpatient glucose goals. This is not, so really important to keep differentiated is glucose goal versus diagnostic criteria. Two different numbers. So A is not the right answer. Nobody chose B. Great job. C, premium glucose less than 110. I put that in there too because we used to use a target of 110 to 140, and that's more for, in the critical care setting. But that's the wrong answer too. It is, we don't say a premium glucose less than 110. This is the non-critical patient. So 50% of you got the right answer, and that's D, premium glucose less than 140. If you didn't get this right, it's okay. I do have a webcast on hospitalization and diabetes, and also there's the ADA standards of care that talk about hospital targets for blood sugars. Melanie wants to know, are there different goals for patients with diabetes and patients without diabetes? Well, once a person has entered the hospital and we have identified that their blood sugars are elevated, and they reach the criteria for diabetes, they fall into these goals. So I don't know if, are you talking about TPN maybe? People on TPN or tube feedings and blood sugars go high? Yeah, so if they're on TPN or tube feedings, they're not officially classified as diabetes, this would still be the target we would want to get them at. That won't be on the exam, but that's just good for our clinical practice. Okay, everyone, well, we spent an hour going through all of, as many questions as I could. We did pretty good. We got through 25. Do you want to do one more? Okay, I'll do one more, but I know it's 5 minutes past our time. So let's just do one more, then we'll wrap up. A patient received 3 units of regular insulin before dinner but couldn't eat due to nausea and vomiting. His blood glucose 2 hours after his insulin injection is 82. Which of the following is the best action to prevent hypoglycemia? Is it A, give the patient a glucagon injection? Is it B, give the patient a D50 IV push? Is it C, have the patient eat 7 Lifesavers? Or is it D, start an IV of D5W? Okay, so let's just go over this again. Patient got 3 units of fast-acting insulin, can't eat, nauseated and vomiting. Blood sugar is 82 after the meal. What's the best action? So he's nauseated and vomiting, but he's conscious. So we're not going to give him a glucagon injection, right? He's conscious and he's alert. Are we going to give him a D50 push? No. His blood sugar is 82. He's not at danger point. That's when we do that, maybe less than 70. He's not there yet. Are we going to have the patient eat 7 Lifesavers? No. He's nauseated and vomiting. Will we start an IV of D5W? Absolutely. So a whole bag of D5W, a whole liter, only has 120 calories. I just had a blank right there. Just, it doesn't have that many calories, so it's not going to push them into, I'm sorry, it has 200 calories. It's not going to push them into a hyperglycemic crisis. And we don't run a bag of D5W, in 1 hour. We run it over 8 hours. So it's 200 calories divided by 8 hours. It's not that much. It's okay. And patients generally in hospital settings are undernourished and they need a little glucose to interact with their insulin. So D is the best answer. And so the rest of the questions I'm going to leave you to do on your own. I hope this has been helpful and you can look at the answers in the university. We have them there for you in the online university. You can look at take it the online questions and look at the answers. So you can see to make sure you got it right. And if you have any questions, let me know. And then I'm going to see you again on Wednesday, but after the exam, please let us know your impressions just in case you can't join us. And we do have our CDE success page where after people take the exam and they pass, they send us a photo and they just share their words of what happened. And this gal, look how cute she is, Leah. She's shopping at the farmer's market and she has this bounty of beautiful colors all around her. And she felt like the boot camp really helped her get ready for the CDE exam. And so I want to share that with you because the more confident you feel and the more prepared, the better you do when you sit down to take that exam. And you certainly have done a lot of work and are really dedicated. I know you're dedicated because you're listening to this boot camp. So you already have a little bit of edge, an edge over your competition because you've really dedicated the time and energy to listen in, to participate, and to really expand your breadth of knowledge. So I want to thank all of you. As always, I'm going to press the stop recording button, but I'll hang around to answer any lingering questions. So we'll see you on Wednesday, everyone, for behavior change and coping. I'm looking forward to it. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.